Congress at some point say, well, inflation is not trustable, so how do we adjust pensions? And they came up with a formula that was completely nonsense.
Welcome to Volkstev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In Argentina, a president is elected, promising a radical package of reforms to stabilize and revitalize the economy. Nope, not Javier Milei. In 2017, the government of Mauricio Macri attempted a fiscal reset. So what happened next, and what can we learn from it? Sebastian Galliani of the University of Maryland was one of the architects of those reforms, and in a recent paper, he tells us the inside story and also draws some lessons for policymakers today. Sebastian, welcome. Thank you for talking to me on Volkstev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
Sebastian, we start in this story in the 2015 election in Argentina. Mauricio Macri is standing for election. What promise is he making to the voters at this time that's different to something they had before?
To understand that, we have to understand that there were three periods before him of populism policies, very liberal democracy, and the economy was stagnated for like 4 years, which in per capita terms means the economy was declining. And inflation was around 25%, but highly repressed. The price of all the energy and other services were repressed, and the exchange rate was heavily repressed. So there was a very much repressed inflation. But there was not a crisis. People were not feeling a crisis. So they want more a political change. And so Macri enacted a coalition with two other parties that was politically very coherent. They were offering to basically finish with corruption, with the manipulation of statistics, with many distortions, and also to eliminate inflation. And that was very appealing to a large segment of the society. But one of the things that also he promised is to reduce taxes, tax pressure. I mean, and it was a topic in the campaign because the previous populist government did something astonishing, basically. It increased the size of the state in 17 percentage points of the GDP. That's like doubling the state. And they increased taxes, the tax pressure, in 11% of GDP. So there was a huge demand for reducing taxes. And Macri himself was very convinced that reducing taxes was very important. The problem is that in the campaign, he and the other main candidates proposed to eliminate basically the personal income tax. And that was not feasible fiscally, but also it doesn't make any sense because in any good tax system, the personal income tax is the backbone of the system, basically.
When the election's finished, then he achieves power in this coalition, but it was a minority government, wasn't it? Why was it so difficult for him to win a majority?
First of all, it's hard to get a majority in Argentina. I don't think since Menem anyone got like, maybe right after Menem, De La Rúa got 49% of the vote. But normally now it's more fragmented and parties get to 40-something percent. Plus, you know, it was a new party, although made a broad coalition, as I say before. Argentina is very much malapportioned. So many of the small districts tend to historically vote the Peronist / populist tradition in Argentina, and so although he made this coalition that barely won in the ballotage by 51% to 49%, so it was a very tight election. Mm-hmm. He only got 19% of the Senate and 34% of the House. And basically that means he has to negotiate everything always. And he was lucky that the Peronists were divided, and that's the reason why he ended up winning the election. Indeed, the Peronists then went united 4 years later, and that was the reason he didn't got reelected. So it's very difficult for the democratic liberal side of society to make a coalition in this electoral system. Historically, it still is. Even Milei still is in minority.
So let's have a look at what he inherited in the economy, because we're telling the story leading up to the 2017 reforms that you were involved with. Argentina was running a pretty big deficit at that time, and it also had some pretty huge pension commitments, didn't it? Can you explain those?
Sure. There were many distortions, as I say, and one was the deficit. The deficit is measured on a payments base, and sometimes it's distorted. And essentially, there is like a debate here of how large it was, but it was large, right? For some people, it was like 4%, the primary deficit, up to almost 6%, the financial deficit. But I was very careful at taking into account things that were not accounted, and because the government was in partial default, part of the interest were not paid, but Macri had to pay them to move away from default and things like that. So you can get up to 8% of GDP deficit, which is unsustainable anywhere. But certainly in Argentina, with a long history of many defaults and not access to capital market. So that was very pressing. But also, you know, he has to start with a big devaluation because of the currency, because the previous government kept the official exchange rate very misaligned with the market exchange rate. Plus, as I say before, all the prices like energy and transportation, many of the things that really impact in the day-by-day life of people were also extremely cheap, but they were part of the reason why there was the deficit. Regarding the second part of the question, basically the pension commitment, essentially to understand this, we have to understand that the previous government also lied with inflation. They cooked the numbers of inflation for like 8 years. So Congress at some point say, well, inflation is not trustable, so how do we adjust pensions? And they came up with a formula that was completely nonsense and that basically was extremely pro-cyclical. Plus, it makes the system unsustainable. In the medium term, pensions tends to grow more than nominal GDP. So the amount of pensions over GDP were always going to increase, which was a time bomb, basically. But also, it has the characteristic that because of some lags and the way it operates, if it reduced inflation substantially, it increased expenditures, real expenditures. And that was a problem because the government has to make an adjustment and also wanted to reduce inflation. So it was key to reform that. But then Macri's program started offering, and it has a logic, this, a gradualist fiscal adjustment. The idea was to reduce expenditures 1-2 points per year and go that way. But the truth is that in the first year, that didn't happen. And if something, it commits increases in expenditures and tax reductions that made the thing even worse. So the adjustment really starts when there is a change of ministers at the end of the first year. And the new minister, Nicolas Duhomne, that appoints me as the deputy minister, starts a serious adjustment and also takes this issue of the formula seriously and end up that year with changing that formula.
Yes, so let's move on to that. These 2017 tax reforms that you were an intrinsic part of, the inheritance that you had in the way taxation was working. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, the system has many distortions. What do I mean by that? Some taxes that are extremely distortive, bad taxes. Essentially, it has a serious problem as the personal income tax is not that large as a share of total revenue as it should be. And that forced government, both the federal and local governments, to use some other taxes that are less efficient. Okay, one big problem was the corporate income tax, which was extremely high, 35% flat in the region, was by a big margin the largest one. And you know, the capital is mobile, and this tax matters. Plus, if you think of from a point of optimality, it's not really clear. I mean, there is a lot of ideological debate about, you know, tax big firms and all that. But what you want to tax is dividends. And so the rest is just a bit of more political debate. So essentially, this was one of the things we changed. Basically, that was a big distortion. I talk later, probably. Let me finish what you asked me, which more of the picture. The other thing is that like 50% of all taxation was done by the federal state and the other by local governments, because it's a federal system. And the local governments were collected also very distorted taxes, like, for example, a tax that accumulates, right? It's not a VAT. It's more like every time there is a sale of a good, it gets taxed. And then when it gets, suppose it's an input, it gets taxed again and again. And that tends to be very inefficient. So there were other distortions. Let's put it broadly that way, because otherwise it will take long to explain every bit there.
So clearly, when you're tasked with making these tax reforms, you have a huge job on your hands. There is a lot that could be changed. Now, the first thing I note about this is that you made these tax reforms revenue neutral. Why was it important to do that?
Well, we designed it to be neutral because, first of all, as I say, in the first year, there were already commitments to reduce taxes by kind of 2 points of GDP, and that was already in the context of a large fiscal deficit. And so there was no room for adding more reductions in taxes at that point. However, we knew that, you know, whatever you design is not going to end up being approved in a Congress in which you have minority, exactly as you did. So the other thing we say is, okay, you know, we have to implement this over 5 years. And that was the only option, and you may think, and we debate this, okay, is it going to be useful or not to do it over 5 years? And we say, well, okay, if essentially investors believe that Macri is going to be reelected, they will believe that this is going to be implemented. And if it's going to be implemented, they will just decide their employment and investment based on this schedule. And in that way, it could be a very useful reform. Of course, if the government was not going to be reelected, they may discount it heavily and say, and in that case, it was less useful. And that is what at the end happened. But you have to bet on that. And that was a bet. And the reason also why we did that bet was because, as I say, the president was a very much supply sider, and he really believed in that he has to do a tax reform. And he said publicly, so it was not politically possible for us as tech technocrats to go and say, no, I mean, this is not the time or something like that, okay? So we have to design a good tax reform that improves the tax system, taking into account the fiscal constraint and the political constraints. And the political constraints were the government is a minority in both chambers, and also we have to negotiate with all the governors that they also adjust their taxes, because also there is this game, right? If you improve the tax system, you open also scope for the governors to increase bad taxes, and then you may end up in a bad, in an even worse situation. So that was basically the political economic game we have to play as an economic team.
So in the opening round of this game, I suppose, what were the plans to change taxation, both at that corporate and individual level?
The first thing was that because of some changes that were done the year before, there was an agreement in Congress that the personal income tax cannot be changed. And that was a problem. So in a way, we designed a tax reform that if Macri was going to be reelected, we were going to go for a second round and change that tax and some other taxes. But in this first reform, there was the only one at the end we did, we passed at the end of 2017. So basically, we worked for a year in its design. I mean, the logic is this, right? You take optimal taxation and you take the system you have and you say, okay, how do I move from here to optimal taxation with all the constraints you have? Of course, you're not going to reach optimal taxation and you know it, okay? You know it, but you try to move into that direction. That's the idea. So one of the things we did was to, as I say, over this 5 years period, was to reduce the corporate income tax from 35 to 30 and then to 25, but only when the profits were reinvested. When they were paid as dividends, still the firm paid to whatever, 25%, but then the owners of the dividends pay the an extra tax to make it 35%. So it was about stimulating investment, not to reduce, essentially, taxation. One is distributed as income. The other thing was, you know, there was no adjustment for inflation. And that's a problem because it makes a corporate tax even higher than 35% because they cannot adjust the real value of their assets. And so we introduced that, but again, you know, that could be very expensive if inflation is high. So there was a clause that say, okay, we reinstate this only if inflation keeps going down, right? Things we have many escape clauses because we were also doing the reform in the middle of a program that was trying to reduce inflation, but it could go well or not in Argentina, right? The history of the country shows that, you know, there's been many, many attempts to reduce inflation and finally things always, for one reason or another, didn't work out definitely. We also thought that, okay, if we're going to stimulate investment and investment, you know, is going to be complementary to skilled labor, we have to do something towards the unskilled workers that are much at disadvantage by the payroll taxes that firms pay in a country where 50% of the labor force works under informality. So we wanted to really reduce it at the minimum wage, so we make a deductible payment exactly at the minimum wage, again, to be implemented in 5 years. That could be expensive in principle, but it was not that expensive because we removed some other schemes that were very bad design and were not targeted to the unskilled, but were targeted as a function of distance to the capital, which, I mean, didn't really necessarily make sense. And that there were some evidence that were not necessarily having the effects that you wanted. So we create that was very original. Some of the, like the IDB and World Bank, then try to adopt it in other countries. I think it's of course, it's the ideal is to eliminate the labor taxes, but they are an important part of, again, of the tax system, very expensive to do that. And so that was a creative way. Then we tried to organize many of the taxes. For example, all countries have taxes on energy, and we just take some of those taxes and redo it as a carbon tax based on emissions instead of being ad hoc. The same with taxes on alcohol, sugar. They were all not well, for example, wine didn't pay taxes, water paid 4%. They were all things that didn't make sense. So we tried to improve on that. And then the most important thing was we cut this deal with the provinces in which they were going to, again, in 5 years, eliminate all the downstream taxes of that system of ingresos brutos that I talked before. So it ended up, after 5 years, being more really of a sales tax and being much less distortive. And we also cut a deal with them to restrict public expenditures, because that was the only way they could finance that. And that was a very arduous negotiation that we saw that could work, because instead of talking to the governors, we talked to all the ministers of finance in each state, and they really were aligned with us in that objective.
They were aligned with you in the objective, but of course there is a hard negotiation to do, because I would imagine that some of your plans they might feel were not always in their best interest. How did you manage that negotiation?
The negotiations were done at multiple levels, but I think what helped was that in the midterm elections, Macri did very well and he won the election. And once that happened, they started to foresee that Macri was going to be reelected, and then they have incentives because of how essentially the Argentine political system worked and how much discretionary transfers also the federal government has to the state to sit on a table and agree. That's the reality. It's not just being a good negotiator. Yeah, of course, it matters, but it matters what you put on the table. But to sit them on the table and to be willing to agree is a political decision that was driven by the electoral result. But once there, I think we basically did macro agreements with by party or by sector within the Congress. But then there are the micro agreements, right? For example, to change the pension reform, that was very difficult, but it was key. Without changing that formula, the stabilization program was not sustainable. And the pension system, as I say, was not sustainable. And at some point, we were lacking a couple of votes. And we have, as I say, for example, a much better sugar tax than the one existing. But there is one province that produced sugar. That's the main product. And the governor didn't want that tax. And he gave us the votes for the pension reform. And we just gave up the change in the sugar tax. And that is what you have to do in politics. It's not, you can't just say, no, I'm inflexible. I want this tax, because you have to have priorities, right? And so we basically operate that way.
So you've made these reforms, you have negotiated with the provinces, and you have tried to eliminate the distortions and simplify some of the complications that have come in. That plan's in place. 2018, there is a macro event that tips everything up. What was that?
Yeah, there is three things that happen. One is that also the government, I think it made a mistake, which it has a program to reduce inflation, but that is based on inflation targeting. And the inflation of 2017 was 25%. Of 2017 was 25%, I said right. And then in 2018, the inflation target that was fixed at the beginning of the government, it was 10%. And no one thought that was credible, and that created problems. For example, the Minister of Labor was saying, no, I cannot get the unions to sign collective agreements at 10%, but they will sign at 15% with a clause that can be revised, something like that. Anyway, so there were many pressures to change that, and there was a consensus within the government, and obviously not the central bank, and not all of us agree, but it happens, and so it was announced that the new target was 15. I don't know if that was that important, but it was seen. But certainly, what was very important is that it was seen as an intervention to the central bank, and that basically put some tension into the credit market, the interest rate. And remember that this government depends a lot on debt. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that Argentina is very much affected by its agricultural output. And there was a huge drought, one of the largest in decades. And that basically hit like 2 points of GDP. And also affects the export substantially. And then the third one was that there was the consensus that they started in April, early April, that the Fed was going to raise the interest rate substantially during the year. And that hit like a capital outflow for many emerging markets. So it didn't only affect Argentina, it affected Brazil, Turkey, and many other countries. But of course, Argentina was fiscally worse than Brazil and Turkey, and it lost its access to the credit market when it still was running deficit. So it has to basically Macri go to the IMF and cut a deal with the IMF that saves his government. But inflation moved up instead of going to 10, it went to 40. And that basically was seen as a crisis in the country. And then, as I say, I think that triggers the Peronists to go united in 19, and they defeat Macri's re-election. And that was basically the end of all these reforms.
So the reforms looked promising, but in the end came to nothing. The lessons that we can draw from this, from the good things that you were able to do, but the frustrations that you had. The first one, and you've spoken about it, is the idea of the credibility of reforms. To be able to get something like this through, they have to be credible. Is that correct?
Yes, because in high volatility countries like Argentina, what matters is not only the law, it's whether people believe it will survive. If the private sector discounts the future tax path, you don't get the investment and formalization response that you expect from the changes you did. And so that's why credibility is crucial, and it's political credibility. And it's not just the credibility that, you may surprise the society because you want to deviate. No, Macri did not want to deviate. He wanted to implement the law. And indeed, during the 2 years after the reform was passed, it was implemented with some exceptions because of the fiscal crisis, but were within the law. I mean, the law has, as I say, escape clauses in case of anticipating the possibility of a negative shock. But the point is that in countries that are very polarized, where you have these irrational populist policies and a government that more rational that tries to improve and make it more capitalist, more efficient, is that where credibility gets broken, when people start to see that the irrational sector is going to come back, when the populist is going to come back, okay? So just to give you an example, one of the first things they did once in 1920, right before COVID, I'm sure if they would have knew about COVID, probably they wouldn't have done it, but was to eliminate all these fiscal responsibility laws so they could spend more again. And so Macri end up giving the government with a fiscal equilibrium, right? Not financial, but primary deficit was zero. So he did an important adjustment. And they just say, okay, now we are going to eliminate this fiscal responsibility law. We're going to spend again. And they changed the formula of pension adjustment to the formula that is, it was not sustainable again. The interesting thing is, okay, you can say, oh, all that effort, all that negotiations, and then they change it. Yes, but there was a lesson. And one of the first things President Milei did was to go back to a formula like the ones that we passed. So, and it was much easier. I think the system learned about the necessity of that formula.
It sounds with these reforms that you were ambitious, but you were not idealistic about them. Is another lesson that we can learn that a good second best negotiation is sometimes essential.
Yes, you cannot be idealistic in politics. I mean, politics, you have too many constraints, right? First of all, within your own government, you have constraints. In the paper, I think the paper is a nice exercise. Because first of all, we are very careful on saying, okay, that's how we think about it, given the constraint, that's what we propose. That is what did not pass our own government. That is what it didn't pass the opposition in Congress, right? And that is what then get changed by lobbies or whatever after the reform is made. Plus, of course, what happened after Macri is not reelected is another story. But yeah, we were not idealistic.
A lot of people will read your paper and will watch this and read across to what is happening now in the Milei government. In what ways are the reforms that the Milei government is trying to enact similar to what you try to do? What ways are they different?
They are different in the following way. And I think it's all part of, you know, these lessons by, but also of the opportunities and constraint, right? I think Milei is the emergence of the collapse of that populist government. So after Macri, they got back into power. It was their fourth term, and they end up in collapse. Basically, inflation was running at 300% at the moment Milei won the presidency. And if you try to keep going in that way, even hyperinflation was going to be an event that happened for sure in 2 or 3 months. So Milei, instead of going with a gradual adjustment, he basically proposed a huge reduction in public expenditures, and that has to be pensions and salaries. That's why it's so expensive, and subsidies. It's all Trump, it's all affected because that's the truth. The federal government mostly spends in interest, in pensions, in transfers, and in salaries. It doesn't spend a lot in goods or things that, you can say, oh, there were inefficient things you can cut. Why Milei can do such a large adjustment so fast is because inflation in 2 months was 50%. Right. So he got 50% of inflation in the first 2 months of government, and he basically did not adjust by inflation all the expenditures so he can achieve fiscal equilibrium in a month. It's something that no one expected. No one believed it was possible. And it was a total different situation from Macri. That's important because Macri assumes with a similar crisis, but the crisis was latent. It was not there. It was not happening. When Milei assumed the crisis was there, everyone was very scared about, okay, we're going to go again to hyperinflation, and that is social distress at the maximum level. I don't want this to sound that Milei doesn't have merit, right? Still, you have to do that adjustment. People don't necessarily like it. And he did it, and not only he did it, he's so committed to fiscal equilibrium that still maintains, after 2 years, fiscal equilibrium. Because Okay, you can say, like I just say, yeah, he had that possibility of doing in the short term because of the situation, because of the high inflation. But then all the pressures from the political system were about increasing again the pensions, increasing again public salaries, increasing transfers to the provinces, all the things that he cut, and he resisted. So he has merit in the fiscal adjustment. And it really proved how important is that the president is so committed to fiscal adjustment. That was something completely new. Now, the question looking forward is, and the other thing is that they didn't go for any gradual reform. So, for example, they didn't do a tax reform yet. They always talk they will do a tax reform, a labor reform. But they say, we will do it when we have the political power to do it. And so they are trying to do a labor reform this year, but not a tax reform, for example. So although they see the same need for reforms than Macri, the same need, similar type of reforms, they are playing differently the timing. And I think in a better way, partly because of the lessons they got from Macri, partly because the initial conditions were different, and partly because Milei has a conviction about certain things that the Macri coalition didn't have, right? Let me say that. Also, the Macri coalition was very homogeneous politically, but very heterogeneous in economic terms. It went from center-left to center-right, and there were very large differences about what course of action in economic that coalition should take. So it was not only a minority, but it was in disagreement. Milei doesn't have that. He really knows where he wants to go, and he's in minority too, but in a much stronger position because of the crisis he inherited was real and not latent, and so people really supported his drastic measures.
Can these drastic measures transform into a sustainable way to reform the state, something that has more of a pattern of the sort of reforms, the gradualist reforms that you wanted to impose? Because, you know, he memorably got into power waving a chainsaw around on stage. You can't do that forever.
No, but he doesn't have to keep doing that. What he needs now is to keep basically reducing inflation, which he did reduce a lot inflation, but still is high. It's about 2% per month. But keep going that way, restoring growth, that will imply sustainable increases in real wages because it will be the result of higher productivity. And going that way, he will get reelected, and with more power in Congress, will be able to do reforms like more deep, like a tax reform and a labor reform that he's trying to do, but maybe some other reforms. So in a way, he doesn't talk about gradualism, but in the long term has a strategy that is similar to Macri. Only was very different in the fiscal stance. Both Macri and Milei know that they have to do some reforms, win election, accumulate power, and do more reforms, right? So just to give you an example, I left the government because I went on leave and my family stays in the United States. So my idea was to go only for 1 year to government to help design these two reforms and then go back to academia. And when I left, the president was very happy with my work and he asked me to prepare, you know, he and the minister, Duhovne, both asked me to prepare a labor reform and a more broad pension reform, not just the formula, but broader reform. And I work on that. And so the idea of Macri was to implement that if he was reelected with a majority in Congress now. Not in the Senate, but at least in the House. So I think this liberal democratic governments that liberal in the sense that respect the constitution and the law and the division of power, that start with minority governments like Macri and Milei, have the view, and is coherent, that they have to accumulate power, and that per se makes the whole program gradual. Okay.
Well, it's a fascinating story, both from the point of view of Argentina and its story in 2017 and now. And I think it also has a huge relevance to policymakers around the world today and in the near future. Thank you for talking about it, Sebastian.
No, thank you very much. A pleasure to be talking to you today.
The paper is called Motives and Constraints in the Implementation of Argentina's 2017 Tax Reform. And the authors are Santiago Alfonso and Sebastian Galliani. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you've heard and seen, well, tell someone else about us. Leave us a review.